And good evening and welcome to a special joint edition of Bird Calls and What's Bugging You from Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Tonight we feature Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, along with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. And we're going to take your calls tonight about the avian world and the insect world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he's been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. And Dr. Beverly Burden is our resident entomologist and associate professor of biology and our biological sciences at LSU Shreveport, a position she has held since 1995. And Cliff and Beverly, thanks for joining me tonight.
Happy to be here, Bill.
Same.
All right. So we invite everybody to call in tonight with your questions, both about our feathered friend and the avian world, as well as the insect world, both the fiendish and the friendly kind, at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. So, Cliff, at the end of last month's bird calls, we had a conservation note, and it's an important one. So why don't we refresh everybody's memory about that?
We ended last month's episode with a tip that we referred back to the species we profiled, the Forster's Tern. It's related to the gulls. And that conservation tip was to properly discard used fishing line. I've seen many birds that have been wounded, injured, encapsulated, if that's the right word, with, you know, entangled is the right word, of course, with fishing line. And so that's one thing that all anglers go through a lot of. It's fishing line, and when you get that knot in the line and you tear it out and you throw it away, make sure it gets into a proper receptacle. So a lot of popular fishing spots, public fishing spots, have that white PVC tube that you can discard your fishing line in. And then the rest of us, if you're not an angler, but you're walking the beach or you're on a fishing dock and you see a big wad of used fishing line, pick it up, put it in your pocket until you can throw it away, because so many birds and sea turtles get entangled in that stuff, and it's just nightmare for a lot of critters. They already have uphill battle to stay alive, and they don't need this one in addition to all the other hazards they have. So it's something we all can do, whether we are fishing or not, but get rid of that used fishing line when it's just blown in the wind.
And it's ironic that a friend of mine just posted a picture of three turtles up on a log, but right in front of the front turtle was a bobber and fishing line. It looked like the turtle had gotten ensnared in it, but he hadn't, thankfully.
Yeah.
So all three turtles were just staring, and she thought it looked like the turtle was fishing.
Yeah.
So I think he fishes in a different way. You are listening to Bird Calls and What's Bugging You tonight. It's a special edition with Dr. Beverly Burden and Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We already have calls online, so we're going to go to Glenn from Texas first. Glenn, you're on with Dr. Burden and Cliff Shackelford. What's your question tonight?
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking the call for Dr. Burton. We just moved to Louisiana, and we have some challenges with what appear to be carpenter bees knocking on the door of my deck on the back of my house. Do you have any recommendations of what we might do to make them go away?
Yes, I do. Carpenter bees are not at all aggressive, and they're not that fast as well. What I do is I keep a hand racket on my back patio, and I just knock them on the ground and step on them. But the other thing I do is you can go to the hardware store and you could get a wooden dowel that approximates the size of the hole. And these are going to be straight holes. It's almost if they took a drill bit and drilled in there. They're so perfect. And just plug them up, because what the carpenter bee is doing is she's actually furnishing she's making a nursery. And so she'll put some food in there, lay an egg, and then she'll just keep going until she comes out. And so if you don't want to do that, then you're going to have to treat the wood. And a lot of people they like the natural look of the wood.
It's usually okay. Cedar, isn't it, that they're after?
No, I've seen them go after oak.
Oak, and,
but
okay.
Not pine very much,
right,
though.
But yeah. So vinyl siding, you know, that's expensive, but that is one solution if you wanted to not have all the holes as well.
Yeah.
I don't think that they've actually made any holes yet. I think they just see the wood and they started swarming around and looking for a place to land. I haven't actually found any holes yet, so maybe I'll use your hand racket idea.
Mm-hmm. That's what I do. You can normally buy them at any garage sale. They'll be out there.
Sure. Well, thank you very much for taking the call.
Thanks for the call, Glenn.
You are listening to What's Bugging You and Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. And we invite you to call in right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. It's interesting, carpenter bees. I was just over in a field of red clovers, and I was taking some photographs because I like to photograph flowers, and there were these big, black, beautiful bees all over the place. They did not bother me at all, but they were jumping from flower to flower to flower, and I happened to get one, and that was a carpenter bee, was it not?
It was.
And so they are also pollinators, so they're also helpful to the environment, especially the plant life out there. So that's something to consider as we think about ecology and not having our house torn down.
Yeah, and actually the larvae that Dr. Burden was talking about, that's good woodpecker food.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we don't want woodpeckers feeding on the side of our house, but in a natural setting where carpenter bees are looking for woods away from our homes, then you've got birds that come along and will help be natural pest control agents for you.
Absolutely. And we're going to go to our next call tonight. This is Don from Henderson, Texas. Don, you're on with Cliff Shackelford and Dr. Beverly Burden. What's your question tonight?
Well, Chris. Yeah, I have a comment and then a question. A couple of days ago, maybe it was yesterday actually, I saw a flock of six great blue herons together in the low-lying watery area of a pasture behind my house. I'm at the city limits of Henderson. And I know that great blue herons are solitary most of the time, except when they're maybe in the breeding season or in the rookery. So I was just fascinated by that and kind of wondering if I often see one by itself occasionally, but I saw six of them cavorting around for over an hour. And just wondering what might I expect next.
Well, the times I see a lot away from the nesting area is near dusk. Dusk or dawn when they're coming on or off a communal roost. And so a lot of birds like herons and egrets like to roost communally. There's safety in numbers, and so I sometimes see them do that. But if there's just one little stock tank, there's probably not enough food in the cupboard for all six herons, and that's probably why most of the time we don't see great blue herons side by side, shoulder to shoulder. They're a big bird that need a lot of cupboard space, so to speak, to fill their bellies. So I'm just curious, was it near dawn or dusk that you saw the six?
No.
Okay.
It was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Okay. And then, you know, some of our great blue herons are migratory, even short distance migrants, and a lot of stuff is moving right now. It could be that they were moving as a unit together. So you might have just seen some travelers that were filling up on a journey.
We just lost him, so he clicked off, or we lost that call. But we thank you for your question, and you are listening to Bird Calls and What's Bugging You with Cliff Shackelford and Dr. Beverly Burden. We invite you to call in tonight. This is a special joint edition of the Birds and the Bees, or the Birds and the Bugs.
It's the second time we've done it.
Yep.
We had such a great time last year during the April episode. We thought we'd do it again. And
absolutely.
It's a lot of fun to have us both in here together and fighting for the calls, and
there you go.
Excited to receive any calls.
Well, give us a call, folks, 800-552-8502. We go to our next call. Donna from Shreveport, you're on with Cliff and Dr. Burden. What's your question?
Yes, I actually changed it. Now I'd like to know how long after my lawn service, against my wishes, put weed and feed on my lawn, how long after that is it safe for bees to revisit my little bee garden?
Well, did they spray your bee garden, or was it just the turf?
They did a spreader, and the granules went all over the lawn. They did not actually go into my wild bed, but that's down the slope, and any rain will have run off into it.
Most of that stuff leaches out of the soil pretty quickly, or it's taken up by the plants. And so I would think if they did it within the last week, give it another week, and it should be safe. Because it is very water-soluble.
Well, they did it last year, and I fired them. But I understood it stayed, these neonics and stuff stayed in the plants for over a year.
With the neonics, that is possible. But, maybe you need to fire this group, too. I don't know. Or just straight off tell them, you don't want any artificial fertilizer. Okay. You might want to go more organic than the artificials.
I don't even do fertilizer at all. It's a native's bed.
Right, and that's probably the best way to do it, just allow it to naturally compost in there.
Okay.
Sorry that happened, Donna.
Yeah, I am too. Like I say, they didn't last long. Well, thank you, guys.
Well, thank you, Donna. And you are listening to a special edition of Bird Calls and What's Bugging You with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502. Now, I found a friend of mine took a picture of a critter that looks a lot like a bee, and I sent it to you, Dr. Burden, and we're going to post this on our website later on. This is a very, very pretty insect, very, very stylish, in fact, but it's not a bee. What exactly is that?
Well, it's a bee mimic. Bees are closely related to wasps and ants, but this is actually what we call a true fly. It's called a syrphid fly, and they do mimic bees, and they are good pollinators, and you'll oftentimes find them on flowers, and they're very easy to identify because they have a classical bee eyes, classical fly eyes, classical fly antenna. But if you look close enough, it has a very important, it's called a ghost vein on the veins of the wings. And it starts from nowhere and it goes from nowhere. And that's a classic. It's a very diversified family also, especially among their immatures, what we would call fly maggots. And there's actually one species where the maggot can actually live in crude oil. And so there's other species that the immatures just live in decaying logs. In fact, decaying logs is a wonderful source of many, many insects, a lot of large beetles and such. I make my entomology students go out and buy these linoleum knives whenever they start collecting so they can dig into old logs because you never know what you're going to find in there. It's fascinating.
So they live on crude oil? Do they devour crude oil?
They can live in it, but they have a very, very long breathing tube.
Okay.
And so the immatures of that family are just totally bizarre. But then the adults are these beautiful flies, about the size of a house fly or a little bit larger. And so you can't judge a fly by its maggots, I guess.
No, these are actually quite pretty, so for flies. So you are listening to a special edition of Bird Calls and What's Bugging You with Cliff Shackelford and Dr. Beverly Burden. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question about birds in the avian world or insects and the fiendish and friendly kind are welcome. And Dawn from Douglas is online next. Dawn, what's your question tonight?
Well, I have a question for Cliff about roadrunners. We just moved from the city of Nacogdoches out to the county, and we have some roadrunners that are on our county roads. And they're fabulous to watch, but they seem to want to dart out in front of your vehicle as you're driving down the road. What makes them want to do this?
There's a wily coyote right behind it.
But you can't trust that coyote.
Yeah, it is going to be the fate of that roadrunner that hops out in front of someone who's going a little too fast. And I think it's just like squirrels, you know, they're doing the same thing. They're trying to take evasive action. And when it's a hawk coming, it's not a big deal. They're going left, they're going to go right. But when it's a car coming with four tires, it doesn't matter if they go left or right. There's going to be probably a wheel that's going to clip it. But so I think it's maybe evasive action is what that roadrunner's doing. But hopefully they get out of the way. The good thing is I don't see a lot of dead roadrunners on the side of the road, especially where roadrunners are way more abundant, like in Central Texas, South Texas, and West Texas, where I spent a lot of time driving, and I just don't see dead roadrunners on the side of the road. So
right.
I think he's probably all right. I'm glad that you're watching, and hopefully maybe your neighbors are watching, because roadrunners are really good neighbors. They're big snake eaters, and if you don't like snakes, this guy's going to help you out. And so I like roadrunners. They're just so cool, so prehistoric looking. And
they're really majestic looking.
They are. And if you get one in good light, they've got several feathers that have some iridescence to them. And so, for example, the tail, the top of the tail can be kind of greenish when the light hits it right. And they're just a classy bird. In the mornings, I don't know if you'll ever see one in the morning, they'll be puffed up where their back is all puffed up, the feathers are parting, and it looks like a bald spot. And you're like, what is he doing? Well, he's like a satellite dish. In the morning, he's cool or cold. He's sitting in the sun. He's moving those feathers out of the way with skin muscles and thus exposing this bare area on the back that is sucking up all this warm sun and keeping him warm. So there's just so many fascinating things to do, to see with a roadrunner. Another classic, we get a lot of calls at Parks and Wildlife from people saying, well, we got this roadrunner, he's right there outside our sliding glass door, he's tapping on the window as if he wants to come in. He doesn't want to come in, he sees his reflection. So a lot of people get to watch the antics of a roadrunner at few feet while they're inside, while the person's inside the den, and the roadrunner's outside looking at its reflection on that glass sliding door. So I don't know if you have low windows, Dawn, or sliding glass doors, but maybe it's time to install some.
Well, we actually see them along the roads on the way to our house. But
yeah.
I have a second question in regards to that. And I've read a little bit about the roadrunners and that they mate for life. And I want to know what happens if one does actually meet an untimely death. What happens to the mate?
Yeah, I don't like this notion of mating for life. It's not reality for most birds. I think what most authors mean is they're mated for that breeding season. Or maybe for multiple seasons, but you know, it's too anthropomorphic, because then we start thinking about divorces and death and is there a widow or a widower? And that's just not, it's just best not to go there with wildlife. And so I like to say that the roadrunner is mated through that breeding season, but I don't know how long they would keep that pair bond going. Could be for a while, but one thing I like to remind listeners about roadrunners is that that was a bird that was not in our listening area a couple hundred years ago. It's because of land clearing and opening up the forest and, of course, roadways, too, that have allowed a bird of the open country to move into East Texas and Louisiana, which was predominantly forested, at least at where we are. And so roadrunners have spread eastward because of land clearing and opening up the landscape. So there in Douglas, where you are, that bird would not have been there even 150 years ago because of what I just mentioned. So he's a recent addition to our area, just like you and me and all our neighbors.
Cool. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Cliff, go ahead.
I've seen a roadrunner here in Shreveport, and I always thought it was so curious. I saw it at the same place for several years, but it would always be going from north to south. It would always travel. I would cross the road north to south. I never saw it going south to north. And then, of course, they put in a rig to harvest the Haynesville shell, and I never saw it after that. What a shame.
Yeah, they are pretty cool, but I don't see – I might see five or six in East Texas in a given year, and often not repeated at the same site. So I think they do move around. If you've got one that's been there for multiple years, consider yourself lucky, because not everybody can say that in our listening area about roadrunners. Now, if you lived, you know, out in the hill country or West Texas, yeah, they're out there and they're there to stay. But here, they're still very spotty, but they are in our viewing area, our listening area.
I always thought of those, of course, from the cartoon, you know, always being out west in the desert area, not in the piney woods area.
That's right. Such.
But,
yeah.
We're clear-cutting enough forest. I guess they figure they can run through the grasslands, too. So.
Yeah, and I mentioned Wile E. Coyote in the cartoons, and the background is pretty accurate in those cartoons, you know, with the desert scenes and lots of exposed rock and not many trees.
I do know that squirrels are in collusion with the insurance companies to run in front of our cars and make us wreck. I saw that on a commercial.
That's right.
You are listening to Bird Calls and What's Bugging You, a special edition. We're going to have some fun tonight, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any call regarding our avian world or our insect world is welcome. We've got two callers online. Paul, please stay with us from Marshall, because we've got to go to Clyde first from Nacogdoches. Clyde, you're on with Cliff and Dr. Burden. What's your question tonight?
We're being bugged, but, you know, it's spring in Texas, so what else can we expect?
There you go.
But what I call about it is there was, I think last session, Cliff talked about some of our introduced vegetation session not being good nectar sources for our things like hummingbirds especially.
Right. I remember that, Clyde.
But I have noticed, or not just recently, but we had a relative who had a house that had a large mimosa, which of course is very much an introduced tree and some consider it a kind of a trash tree. Out behind his house, and every spring it was just swarmed with hummingbirds. I mean, it looked like you had flocks of hornets flying around in there. Is that usual, and would you think it would be a good idea to plant a mimosa to attract hummingbirds?
I stick to my guns about natives, so that is one of the exceptions. And I, growing up, my great-grandmother lived near Forest, Texas, not far from Alto, Texas, and she had a mature mimosa in her yard, and I saw the same thing you did. Lots of ruby-throated hummingbirds coming to the mimosa, but I'll tell you also what no one ever did was park their car under the mimosa, because they're constantly dripping a nasty, sticky sap.
Well, absolutely.
Yeah.
We had one in Texas City, and fortunately it was in a corner of the backyard opposite, diagonally across from the driveway.
Yeah. So I would say if you're going to plant a tree, go with something native. Dr. Bird and I, before the presentation, I was mentioning a book that I think is one of the Bibles for plant-insect associations. It's called Bringing Nature Home by Doug Tallamy. And he talks about oaks, number one, whatever's native in your area. Willows are really good. This is for attracting LEP larvae. That's butterfly and moth larvae. And then for the bird person, that's your bird food. So it's all connected, all food web connected. So you put the plant out, you'll get the insect, and then you'll get the bird and so much more. And you'll see the environment working together as it's supposed to if you go with native. So I can't stress it enough. The book also talks about a lot of the plant insects that are specific to certain plants. Many of the insects, and Dr. Burton can elaborate more than I, on how many of these insects are specialists, and so they need to have a certain species or genus of plant to survive. And if we replace those with Bradford pears and crepe myrtles and Chinese tallow, we're doing nothing but wrecking the system. I mean, I hate to say it, some of those plants are just as bad as putting pavement and rooftops out there. They're just not contributing at all to nature.
Well, Chinese tallow is really bad for a whole bunch of reasons.
That's right. That's right.
Thinking of your roadrunners that the lady called about, when we lived out in Douglas, we saw a pear and a grown chick one time.
Oh, cool.
And a fight with a hawk.
Ah.
Oh, my.
Yeah. Cool. Well, there's never a bad observation with a roadrunner, so you can't go wrong with that bird at all. So,
all right.
Great. Thanks for the call, Clyde.
And we're going to go to our next call. You are listening to a special edition of Bird Calls and What's Bugging You with Cliff Shackelford and Dr. Beverly Burton. You can call us tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Mike from Nacogdoches, please hang on the line for a moment. We've got to go next to Paul from Marshall. Paul, you're on with Dr. Burton and Cliff. What's your question?
Hey, Cliff. Talked to you a couple of weeks ago, and I'll try to make it quick here.
Okay.
I think I had a flight of tufted titmouse pass through, and what was so curious about it is I've got a bird bath in the front yard, and they would crowd around that and flutter around it, and it was just remarkable to see them. Now, the one I got up close to had a sharp yellow stripe across the tail.
Okay, well...
what does that sound like?
That sounds like what we call a butter butt, and it's the correct name is yellow-rumped warbler.
Okay.
They're little gray guys, and they get in big numbers.
Right.
And I've actually filmed them in my backyard six at a time, sharing the bath together. And you'll see that little splash of yellow on the back of the tail, and that's where he gets the name Butterbutt. So that's the colloquial name for the yellow-rumped warbler. So I'm betting that's what you had.
Yes, sir, and I think they've already gone. There was probably 15 or 20 of them.
Uh-huh.
Big group.
Yep.
And I think they've moved on.
Yeah, they're a winter bird here, and so they're still around in small numbers, but you probably did see the first rush of birds trying to get back north.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so you said that was at your bird bath?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and I can't stress how important a bird bath is in our listening area or any really anywhere that people are listening. You can put out all the feeders you want. You'll get a select few species. You know, hummingbird feeder, obviously you're going to just get a few species.
Mm-hmm.
And seed feeder, only things that are eating seeds, but every bird's going to take a drink. Most every bird is going to take a bath. And so a bird bath is more of a grand central station that you can create in your backyard. So I'm glad you're running a bird bath, Paul, because that's really good.
And that seems so social. I mean, they gathered around there and just, they just filled it up. It was really
awesome. And a lot of it, if you watch birds come to a bird bath, you and I know there's no fish, turtles, big black bass, largemouth bass, rather, in there to eat them. But those birds are always on the lookout for predators. So when one is in the bath bathing, the others are like, hey, it's safe. Let's all get in. So that's a lot of it with these birds is they're real wary. The smart ones are wary, and they're really checking out their environment. And they also have to look, you know, for the shrubs nearby that might harbor a feral cat or someone's outdoor cat, too.
Uh-huh.
So that's why you see sometimes a 6 or 12 yellow rumps is because somebody said, hey, there's no turtles here to eat us. There's not going to be a bass under the water coming up to get us. Let's go. And so they kind of cooperatively or communally take baths and drink at the same time. And it's a lot of fun to watch. And it's usually pretty quick, too.
It was.
Yeah. They're,
remind me the name again, and I'll go.
Yeah, yellow-rumped warbler.
Yep.
And do you remember the colloquial name I mentioned?
It's Butterbutt.
Butterbutt. Can't forget that one. Yeah, it looks like a little dab of butter right on the behind.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you guys.
Great, thanks, Paul.
All right, thanks, Paul. Sounds like a South Park name to me, Butters.
Butterbutt, yeah.
You are listening to a special edition of Bird Call and What's Bugging You with Cliff Shackelford and Dr. Beverly Burden. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have all but one line open right now, so you'll get right in. And we're going to go next to Mike from Nacogdoches. Mike, you're on with Cliff and Dr. Burden. What's your question?
Well, thank you very much. I've always been interested in birds, you know, what kind of birds were here when the settlers came here. But that was my first question. But on the phone, I was thinking I have all these magpies around the house. And I was wondering, I know one of them in the house, and they're always trying to get in the house. So I was wondering, what could I do to make a birdhouse for them, something around the house where they could come and what kind of structure would be the best for them?
Well, let's stop there a minute. So you're saying magpies and Nacogdoches?
Yeah, Nacogdoches County. They're always trying to get in my shed or the house, or, you know, they're always flying around in the house and they seem to like people, you know.
Well, so I'm confused because we don't have magpies anywhere close to Nacogdoches. You've got to drive to Colorado. You've got to drive to Red River, New Mexico to see a magpie. Right. So you got to drive 800 miles west to see a magpie.
Well, okay. Well,
so I don't know what we're talking about.
It's a little bird with sort of a curved beak.
Okay.
That's trying to get in my house. I mean, every year.
That's probably Carolina Wren.
Oh.
Yeah, okay. And he's a little brown guy, and they like to nest in shoe cubbies, or if you have flowering pots, or if you even have a coffee pot on its side, they'll try to nest in that.
And they're not afraid of people. It doesn't seem like.
Yeah, they feel very comfortable around people because we're not a threat to them, and we probably discourage the things that would be a threat, like snakes and cats. So Carolina Wren is probably your bird, and what you can do is look for a wren box that's sold online. But like I mentioned, an old boot tacked up to a wall, a lot of people have done that.
Yeah.
They've taken an old shoe and tacked it up to the wall, and a Carolina Wren will fill it in 3 days with all kinds of loose leaves and roots and grass, fine grasses, and they might use it, they might not, because one thing you have to watch out with wrens is they build what's called a dummy nest, and a dummy nest is not used. But it's kind of like they don't want to give away the location of the bat cave. So it's like, well, I'm going to be real showy when I go to the dummy nest and there's no eggs in there, but I'm not going to tell anyone.
It seems like they're pretty smart.
They are pretty smart. And so you got to make sure you're not looking at the dummy nest. So you might put up more than one boot on different sides of the house, or coffee cans, or something else like that. But people that have open sheds, open garages, they learn real quick not to ever close that garage if the wren has built a nest, because then you've disrupted this beautiful family event.
Yeah.
And you've separated, you know, mom from kids. Sounds like something happening down the border these days. But anyway, we don't want to do that. And so keep all the family together and let them finish out their nesting cycle.
I really like them. You know, I always thought they were from the crow family, raven family, you know, real smart.
Oh, yeah.
But it seems like they're smart enough.
Yeah. Know? No, if you go online, Mike, and look up black-billed magpie, he's a monster compared to the Carolina Wren. He's just very large with a long tail. He's a lot bigger, longer than our crow that we have around here. So he's a very large bird that's got black, white, and blue. And again, you got to drive about 800 miles west of here to pick those up.
Okay. Well, I've got, if you have time, I've got one more question.
Okay.
I mean, if you want to elaborate on something, I've always been really interested in, like, what kind of birds were here when the settlers came here.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you mentioned that. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, so there are several birds that are completely gone that were here when settlers first came here. Ivory-billed woodpeckers, Carolina parakeet, passenger pigeon, they're gone. There were greater prairie chickens in the Marshall area. Actually, one of the last records in Texas for greater prairie chicken was in the Marshall area, which is only about, 80 miles north of you, Mike. And that's not something that you can find in Texas anymore, is the interior subspecies of greater prairie chicken. You can still find the Atwaters, thanks to man's doings, because actually every Atwater's prairie chicken that's alive is because of someone's efforts raising them in cages and reintroducing them down on the coast just west of Katy, Texas.
Those
are just four examples of birds that used to be here. They wouldn't have seen the roadrunner. I mentioned that. The cliff swallow was not here yet. House finch was not here yet. So there were several birds that are here that would have been missed 200 years ago.
Is the roadrunner related to an ostrich?
No, not at all. No. The roadrunner is a cuckoo related to yellow-billed cuckoo and black-billed cuckoo and the awnies. So he's a cuculid and not at all related to the ostrich.
Yeah, I thought it was like maybe related to that bird that was dominating North America from South America in the prehistoric days. I forget about I don't. It's called the terror bird.
Yeah. There's a lot of those things that I'm not very familiar with. That they're fossil records of a lot of things, and
yeah,
I'm not brushed up on my archaeology.
Well, so. That's fascinating, because the two-legged birds are really amazing. I mean, they really make time on two legs.
Yeah. Yeah, and roadrunners do fly, and you can see that. You'll see them when they're in a real big hurry, like Don, who called earlier. If a car gets really close, you'll see a roadrunner take flight, and they've got a lot of white in the wings and tail. They're real pretty, or maybe the white's just in the tail, but you can see them fly. They'll usually hop up to the nest. The nest is often 10 or 20 feet up in a thick tree like a cedar, and they'll sometimes glide out of it when they're done. So the roadrunner does like to fly, but he prefers to do everything on foot. Yeah So cool. All right, I liked your question about what was here before we were here, so yeah.
All right, you are listening to a joint episode of What's Bugging You and Bird Calls with Dr. Beverly Burden and Cliff Shackelford, and our phone lines are all open right now. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Now, the emu and the ostrich, are they related?
Well, we collectively call those and the rheas rheitites.
Okay.
And so but they don't occur in the same biogeographic area of the world, so they dominate different parts of the globe. So, but no, we collectively call those all rheitites: emus, ostriches, rheas, and yeah,
kiwis.
No, not kiwis. Kiwis aren't rheitites, so they're a little different.
But they are big birds, aren't they?
No, kiwis aren't tall and running.
Okay.
They're little forest birds that are smaller than a volleyball,
mm-hmm.
and just clamber around and don't run around like those big birds. But
mm-hmm. Well, I was living in Florida, and an emu was on my property once one morning.
Oh.
On a foggy morning. There was an emu farm down the road, and this one had gotten away, and I saw what looked like a raptor. Of course, I just watched Jurassic Park, so, you know, it had to be a raptor.
And boy, emu farming is not in vogue anymore.
No.
You know, it was in the 80s and 90s, and it was, everybody was saying how, you know, you can make a living and with the emu oil and their feathers and the meat, and boy, that didn't last long, did it?
No, but they'll eat anything in Florida, so you know. You are listening to a joint episode of Bird Calls and What's Bugging You with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton. And we've got a couple of calls online, but before we go to that, Beverly, is there anything in the world that will eat fire ants? Mm-hmm. And can we get more of those things here?
I don't know. My best guess that it might be sometimes some lizards, because the horned toad over in central West Texas will eat large red ants, but they won't eat the red imported fire ant at all. And so if anything does eat them, I don't know. And we're not going to get rid of fire ants. They're here to stay, Bill.
Well, there's so many people who like the hot sauce. Maybe we could figure out how to get that people liking that formic acid. Would that? That's a joke.
I wonder if habaneros on the fire ants, would they like that or not?
Yeah. I think the tummy aches would ensue after trying that formic acid.
But I will tell you that they're introducing a small fly as a form of biological control. And they do eat the fire ants, but it's the small... They hover above a fire ant, they lay an egg, the egg hatches, it crawls in between the joints, and it literally eats the fire ant body inside.
Yeah,
and it kills, and it's called a little forid fly, P-H-O-R-I-D, and after the fly pupates, the head of the fire ant will fall off and it just crawls out.
And I've always thought that these ideas would make great horror flicks.
I know.
Absolutely. And
Hollywood can't come up with things better than
this. Yeah, exactly. Nature's been doing it forever, and we get all worked up over Chainsaw Massacre. They ought to look at what, like she mentioned, these forid flies are doing. I think the most remarkable are the ichneumatid wasps that can drill in wood. They can't see the larvae, the beetle larvae, deep in the wood, but they can drill in and with pinpoint accuracy lay an egg in it, and then that beetle larvae lives for a little while longer while that ichneumonid larvae eats the guy from the inside out. And I mean, you talk about a horror flick. Mm-hmm. Where is Hollywood?
I think that's where they got Alien from, you know.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's very much like that.
Probably so. All right, you are listening to Bird Calls and What's Bugging You tonight, a special joint edition, and our phone lines are open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Lucas and Jennifer, please stay on hold for a moment. We've got to go to our next caller, Leon from Bossier City. You're on with Cliff and Dr. Burton. What's your question?
I have seen a lot of beautiful little ladybugs lately, and I wonder what kind of a monster would eat a ladybug.
Cliff, do you know of any birds that eat ladybugs?
No, and I've seen plenty of congregations that would scream of you know, okay, somebody needs to be capitalizing on this, but you don't see it happening.
But ladybugs are insectivores, aren't they? They're carnivorous?
Yes. They like to eat primarily aphids. Both the adults and the immatures of ladybugs will eat aphids. And so they're very, very beneficial insects, except for the Asian ladybug, and it's an introduced species, and it will actually eat plants. But and there's a lot of variation in the dot and color patterns of ladybugs. There's one ladybug that just has two big red dots on it. We call that the twice stab ladybug, but they're always going to have that very convex shape. And so if the birds aren't eating them, I know that there's no insects that eat the ladybugs, so I guess they're pretty safe.
Yeah, but they are helpful in that sense. I mean, they eat, you know.
They're very beneficial.
Yeah, very beneficial. I think they're cute.
So.
That takes Cliff off the roster. With
none of my birds are bad guys eating your beautiful ladybugs, right?
That's right.
You would think they would have a natural predator, though, because almost every species has its own natural predator.
I know. I'm going to have to look into that.
Yeah. Well, why do the ladies get off? All right. You are listening to Bird Calls and What's Bugging You with our special guest, Cliff Shackelford and Dr. Beverly Burton, and getting everything mixed up here. And you can call in right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Jennifer, please stay on the line. We're going to Lucas and Lee next, or Leah, from Nacogdoches. You're on with Cliff and Dr. Burton. What's your questions?
Hi, guys.
Hi.
This is Leah from Nacogdoches, and my 9-year-old son has a question, a couple of questions about wasps.
Okay.
Lucas.
Are wasps any good to the environment?
Oh, absolutely. All wasps are predators, and they're normally predators on caterpillars. All caterpillars feed on plants, and sometimes they'll feed on our vegetable plants, and sometimes they'll feed on our herbs, and sometimes on our fruit trees. And so wasps are extremely beneficial. Do you have another question, Lucas?
How can we keep wasps away from our home?
Well, you know, Lucas, that's everybody's always asked me, when are the insects going to take over the world? And I tell them that they already have. Okay? So there's lots of different types of wasps. Now, the wasps that have stingers that build the paper nest, what you have to do is you just have to cooperate with adults and go around the house every other day and see if you can spot them starting a little nest. And if you see them starting a little nest, then you want to go ahead and knock it down, and they'll go someplace else. Or they'll come back and you can just keep knocking it down. Now, another common wasp that you see around houses a lot are called the mud daubers. And these are also beneficial insects because they're building nurseries and they're putting living spiders in there. And so that's a pretty fascinating too. There's many other different types of mud daubers. And so I would say just be very, very observant. Go outside. Notice your environment.
Great.
That's really interesting. I didn't realize, we call them dirt daubers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize you said spiders?
Mm-hmm. And some species will specialize in certain species of spiders as well. In fact, a lot of people do surveys of spiders in the area, and they focus entirely on dirt daubers or mud daubers. Yep.
Wow, that's interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Leah.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. And you are listening to a joint episode of Bird Calls and What's Bugging You with Cliff Shackelford and Dr. Beverly Burton. You can get her right in now, 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502, with a question about the avian world or the insect world. All right, Ethan from Shelby, please stay on hold for a moment. We've got to go to Jennifer from Leesville. Jennifer, you're on with Cliff and Dr. Burton. What's your question?
Well, I have two. One is for the avian world, and one is for the bugs.
Ah, egalitarian.
All right.
Okay, so I'll hang up after I ask my question.
Okay.
But how can we encourage songbirds, especially bluebirds? I think bluebirds are songbirds. I don't know. There's some little tiny bluebirds, and I don't know what we've done to encourage them, but I want to keep encouraging them. And I'm not talking about blue jays. Those are mean little birds.
Huh.
But the bluebirds or any other songbird, and the question about the bugs is, what kinds of things can we do to encourage our honeybees to stay around? And I'll hang up and listen.
Should we go in order that we were asked? Okay, so encouraging songbirds, that one I always talk about putting out a wildscape, and a wildscape is landscaping for wildlife, and it's not something you do in a three-day weekend. It's something you're going to start one day and you're never going to finish, because it's a wonderful road to seeing all kinds of nature coming to your backyard. So if the bluebird is a songbird, and if you're specifically trying to get bluebirds, there's an easy fix for that, or easy thing to do, and that's in the breeding season, put out a bluebird box. You can buy one. Here's the call of one that Bill's playing right now. Let's listen to the bluebird.
I see these all over the place. They're so pretty.
And we've profiled that one before, but if you don't want to buy a box, you can look online for blueprints and build your own bluebird box. And the thing with bluebirds, they're pretty finicky, and I wouldn't just put one box up. I'd probably put several. How many is several? You decide. But don't just settle for one because they are finicky. The box might not be pointing the right direction. It might not be the right height. They're really finicky. So if you have choices, thus multiple boxes, there might be one on your property that the birds will like, and they'll stick around and breed and have baby bluebirds. So that's how I would answer that part of the question. Go ahead, Beverly.
Well, this is something that Cliff and I talk about together all the time, and that is native plants. If you want to be friendly to the, especially the honeybees or any bees at all, put out a lot of flowering plants, and the more native they are, the more they'll be attracted to them. Ironically, though, the typical honeybee is not native to North America. They brought that in when they settled Jamestown, but they've adapted to North America very well. But flowering plants, the more native, the better. They keep the pollinators around. And that just goes for honeybees, but it's all pollinators.
And are carpenter bees native to North America?
I believe they are, Bill.
So they love the red clover. I've seen a lot of red clover blooming all over the place, just vast amounts. And you walk up into that, you know, tall grass and clover grass, and you'll see these carpenter bees just popping up in and out of the flowers as they go around gathering their nectar.
So. Yeah, and the clover is a good example of something that's cool season. And it reminds us that we can't just have one species of plant out because a lot of these plants are very seasonal, and what I mean by that is they might only have a 6-week or 2-month window that they're operating, and then they shut down. So the horticulture people, the botanists know this, that you've got to have a variety of nectar-giving plants.
Diversity,
and that's the key. So don't just say, I'm going to just do clover or just Turk's cap. You need to do a little bit of everything and study the plant. That's why I said this is a lifelong endeavor. It's so much more enjoyable to learn as you go, to master it as you go, and continue to revise as you go. But you want to have some salvias, you want to have some Turk's caps, you want to have that variety that we mentioned. That way there's always something in your yard giving nectar, except, of course, when there's a freeze. But for probably 10 months of the year in our latitude, you can have nectar-giving plants.
You are listening to a joint episode of Bird Calls and What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton, and our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We've got lines open right now and just a little bit time left, so go ahead and call in now at 800-552-8502. 800-552-8502. Kathleen from Texas, please stay on hold because we've got to go to Ethan from Shelby County, Texas next. Ethan, you're on with Cliff and Dr. Burton. What's your question?
I was wondering what all kind of insects pollinate. You know, I know bees pollinate plants. I was just wondering if there's any other kind of insects or any kind of birds that do pollination also, and how much do they pollinate compared to the bee?
Well, yes, everybody knows about the bees, but there are a lot of beetles that pollinate as well. And, you know, there's more beetles than almost any other type of insect. So beetles, there's a lot of different species of beetles. And they will pollinate as well, and Cliff knows that there's a lot of birds that will pollinate, and even some bats that will pollinate.
That's
especially,
right.
Especially nocturnal flowering plants.
Yeah, and we don't have any of those bats in our listening area. You have to go to the arid Southwest before you pick those up, and then lots in the tropics. But she's right. There are beetles, and they're clumsy. When you see a beetle get on a plant, he's not very coordinated. He's messing around, and But the whole time he's getting all kinds of pollen brushed up all over him, and then when he flies the next plant, he's doing his job. So bird, the dominant bird in our area that's going to be pollinating are going to be the hummingbirds, but they don't compare. The bird world does not compare to the insect world. They are they're really doing this service for nature and for us. We've talked about this before. If you like to eat food, you need to learn about pollinators, because about every third bite in our diet is thanks to a pollinator. So we have a lot to thank these beetles, these butterflies, these hummingbirds, bees, etc., that are pollinating for us, because that brings us more of these plants that are part of our diet.
Now, do beetles actually gather the nectar or the pollen, or is it just they're rubbing across it and taking it to the next plant?
It's a secondary thing, as far as I know. And a lot of times, even some beetles that are predators, they'll predate on things that are coming in to pollinate, and they will inadvertently pollinate themselves. And Cliff's right. Beetles can't hover like bees and flies can. They're good flyers, but they're not good hoverers. And that's what you're normally looking for when you're looking for, you know, pollinators, especially those that are going in for the nectaries of the flower as well.
All right. And we've got a couple of calls online. We're going to try to get to these folks real quick. Robert from Shreveport, please stay online. We've got Kathleen from Texas next, and then Julie also stay online as well. Kathleen, what's your question tonight?
About 8 or 10 years ago, when I was on the computer online, I noticed that some entity in Texas had a thing going where people could get certified to catch starlings and dispatch them humanely. And the number of starlings was, you know, going down and going down. This went on for a few years. And then, as far as I know, they stopped doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And...
No,
and now I see lots and lots more starlings than I did 6 or 7 or 8 years
ago. Yeah,
I was wondering if they were going to pick that up again.
I think we're getting the species mixed up, because it was cowbirds that people.
Oh, cowbirds?
Yeah, yeah. We've never had a program where we encourage people to do starlings, and namely because it's a non-native bird. It doesn't have any state or federal protection. So the full name is European starling. Guess what?
Right.
They're not native here. So they
I
have, again, no state or federal protection. So you can do whatever you need to do. Of course, you can't discharge a firearm in the city limits if that's what you're thinking, or not you, but anyone. But no, cowbirds are brood parasites. This is the brown-headed cowbird is
right.
the main player. And there were a lot of... protections for that bird until people found out that, you know, they were what kind of damage they were doing to a lot of endangered species, namely the black-capped vireo out in central Texas. So there were landowners, they were encouraged to put out traps to remove brown-headed cowbirds, and people still do that. They just have to show that they have an endangered species on their property before they can get certified to do that. So it's not for everyone at all. So all right, Kathleen. Well, thanks for the call very much.
All right. We've got two more callers online. We're going to try to get to both of these real quick if we can. Julie from Nacogdoches, please state your question very quickly if you could.
Sure. I had a bug question, actually, specifically ants. I remember about 5 years ago, all we were hearing about is about the raspberry crazy ant,
mm-hmm.
and how they were going to make fire ants look wimpy. And I'm wondering, whatever happened, are they still a problem in Texas? Are they going to move into the listening area, or what's the status of the crazy ant?
Well, there was a lot of concern about it, like you said, 4 or 5 years ago, but that's died down basically because the population is stabilized and it's just not noticeable anymore. And so I wouldn't worry about the crazy ants.
All right. Mm. And we're going to go to our last caller now, Robert from Shreveport. You've got just a few seconds. State your question, please.
Okay. A couple of years ago, I planted a couple of begonia plants. They gave off a real nice smell. And so we thought about replanting some more. But one of them died this year, this winter. Was I not taking proper care of it, or what?
Well, remember what we talk about, and Beverly does too, is native species. So I would say change the song that's playing in your head. Don't sing the begonia song anymore. Sing a different tune. Rusty Blackhaw is a great one. You need to sing that tune.
There you go. All right, and that is all the time that we have tonight, Cliff and Dr. Burden. Thank you so much for joining us for another special edition of Bird Calls and
so
What's Bugging You.
I learned so much sitting next to her. It's really
same
cool.
Here.
Yeah,
it's,
this
you know,
is so much fun.
Wonderful. Thank you.
All right. You have been listening to a special edition of Bird Calls and What's Bugging You with Cliff Shackelford and Dr. Beverly Burden. And we want to thank both of them for coming in tonight and sharing their expertise with us. This program was produced by Bill Beckett, along with Cliff Shackelford and Dr. Beverly Burden, with help tonight from Wally Derlett, Tim Schnell, Sheila Lawrence, and Renee Moran. The audio for tonight's program will be posted on our website in a few hours, as well as photographs of some of the bugs we talked about tonight. Our next edition of What's Bugging You is going to be on Tuesday, May 21st, and the next edition of Bird Calls will be on Tuesday, May 14th. You are listening to Red River Radio, and we are KDAQ, Shreveport, Bossier City, KLSA, Alexandria, Pineville, KBSA, El Dorado, Magnolia, KLDN, Lufkin, Nacogdoches, and KTYK, Overton.